no people working on a local level in the whiskey industry or the beer industry. And this could be in the early 50s, the late early 50s. I know it was during the whole 40s. So, one day, let's see, this thing's been, this has been, what was the date on this? This has been over 23 years now. God, let's see, there's no date on it. 5:30 p.m. You see a date on that?
No, I don't really.
No? Let's see, 5 p.m. These tickets. We read one of them.
Yeah. Carlin's Park.
Carlin Park, National Bull Carnival Time. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, July the 30th, 31st, and August the 1st. Okay?
Right.
This is a good 30 years or more. At that time, I opened this place downstairs called the Club Casino in 1940. So this place been downstairs 37 years.
Yeah.
One day, my beer representative from Globe Distributing Company, their brand name beer was Arrow Beer. Before World War II, during the 30s, and up to World War II, the black people, they drank more Arrow beer. They were the backbone of Arrow beer.
Mm-hmm.
After World War II, and all the representatives from the beer companies were white. You didn't have no blacks. The men on the trucks, the men that helped on the truck. You didn't have a black doing anything but in the tavern buying the beer and drinking the beer.
Yeah.
And so, after World War II, National Beer, who is the National Bowl right now, and belongs to the Huffburgers. One day, downstairs, a representative that had been representing Arrow Beer since the time I went into the business in 35, and I'm talking about 10, 11 years later, because it was after World War II. Arrow Beer dipped like that to nothing, the sales drop. Blacks stopped drinking Arrow Beer. They started drinking Gunther's beer, and they were drinking Bohemian beer, National beer.
Mm-hmm. Why it was the change, do you know?
Well, what I understand what happened is that, and I never was a beer drinker, I couldn't witness to this myself, but seemingly something about the cork that the Arrow beer had in its loop, in the inside of the cap that goes over the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Something caused the beer to have a different taste. It must have gone on for some time. It changed all the people over from it to these other
yeah.
beers. So Harry Stone was a fellow with, that I've known from the time old Little Willie's in 35 and down here in the late 40s. He walked in downstairs one day and brought, had me these. He says, your people drink all of National's beer. He says, but they don't do this for your customers, I bet you. And he handed me this ticket. And it was where you could take your people out free, as it reads there, to Carlin's Park. You remember Carlin's Park?
Right, sure do.
Okay. I knew that Carlin's Park wouldn't let blacks in. Wait a minute, this was, I'll tell you when this was. This was the early 50s. Because
yeah.
I'd opened Carl's Beach. Now, I'd opened Carl's Beach. I opened that in 1950. That was a public beach for blacks down below Annapolis.
Yeah.
Commercial beach, because the blacks had nowhere to go either. But to segregated beaches. So we had two beaches down there, Carl's Beach and Sparrow's Beach. So, we had a black organization, Tavern Owners, by that time. This was in the 50s. So Mr. Stone gave me this. I got over to my man, the manager downstairs, who was Mr. Ross at the time. I said, Mr. Ross, get on the telephone and call National Beer and tell them that you want your tickets. You didn't get your tickets for the people to go to Carlin. Mr. Ross got on the telephone and he asked him, came upstairs, yeah, to the office. I got on one phone and I didn't do the talking anymore. So first the person said, well, I don't know why you didn't get it. The whole lot. So then somebody else got on the phone and came back. They said, well, where are you located? He says, I'm at the Club Casino, and I didn't get any tickets to send my people this week. He says, oh, Mr. Ross, he says, look, you know, they don't accept blacks at Carlin Park. And said, but we help promote the beauty shows and all down at Carl's Beach and so on. I'm sitting right on the telephone. So immediately, I got on the telephone and called all the other black paranormals. Comedy Club was open down the street, Gammons across the street, and Burns had a place on Madison, any number of places, and started them to call. And then they realized something was happening. So they stopped, we'll send somebody out to see it. They stopped talking on the telephone. They didn't want to talk about it. This was a national piece. So they sent a representative out. So then they sent a representative out to try to explain the thing and why that they didn't segregate, didn't want it, but they couldn't do nothing about it. So then we took it to the Urban League and had the Urban League make contact with National. And National, God, the blacks were caring National as far as they'd be able to come through at this time. Really drink nothing but National Delhi. So we opened the doors. National was the first one. That was in the 50s. I'm positive at the time. We opened the doors for National to hire their first black representative. Represent them what they feel locally.
But you never got into Carlin's at that time.
Oh,
right?
No, we never got into Carlin's. But I've kept these things, and they're about 19, could be 50, 51, 52, somewhere in there. And I know they're 25 years.
Was the black representative hired by National Vaux, was that before the Supreme Court decision in 54 or after?
That was before the Supreme Court.
All right, so in other words, some modest advances were being made before that school desegregation case.
Right. Now, you see what had happened, like the National...
And here you were using economic power to bring about change.
That's right. And we did the same thing with the whiskey companies. After we opened this, we went to Cromhine, who has a company now, Cromhine, here and have it in Washington. Mr. Cromhine met with us at the Urban League. We went right into them. Blacks drink more liquor than anybody else at that time. If you take a survey, they could go around there. All the blacks was tied in. In Baltimore City, they had the city and districts for the liquor board. Not talking about the political district as such, but they had all the black community. They could tell you how much whiskey from the reports the controller gets. They could tell you exactly how much liquor was drunk in black neighborhoods.
More whiskey was being drunk per capita than in the white neighborhoods?
Oh my God, yeah, you'd be surprised. They would even tell the percentage of the population that we were at that time 30% or 20-some percent of the population, we were drinking 50% of the food.
Yeah.
In Baltimore City. Yeah. So Mr. Cromhine, he came over from Washington and had his representative, and through our effort, the first black liquor salesman locally to go around to the taverns and take the orders was hired through Cromhine. We opened the door on that. We did that as tavern owners and saying we were going to boycott. And even my father with the Hofburg, they had the Harness racetrack out at Philadelphia Door, the big shopping center out there on old Route 40 going to Philadelphia.
Yeah, what's that, East Point or?
One of those shopping centers, yes.
Yeah.
They had that and they had the harness race and you go out that night. And we even broke that down as far as the toilets was concerned. If we go to the races, one of the people go to the races, so we were there. they would give you tickets to go out there, National Forward. But you would go out to the races, and the windup is they had, you know, black men, white men, something, colored women, white ladies.
Well, I didn't think they did that in the Baltimore area. I thought that was only on the Eastern Shore and Southern Maryland.
That was right here in Baltimore, too.
They did?
Yes, no question about it.
When did that stop, the segregated toilets?
I really don't know, but it was had to be sometime in the early 60s or late 50s, mm-hmm. Not before.
Did the taverns provide sort of a gathering ground for political operations or not?
Oh yes, during those days, the taverns played a bigger role than any other organization as far as the political role was concerned, because the people that was involved politically mostly were people that would go into taverns and all. You had the, up until, you know, religion always played a great role. The churches, even in the mid-50s, not until after Martin Luther King came along, you couldn't get a minister to get in the pulpit and say nothing about politics, politically, about people voting. They just didn't do it. I'm talking about the black churches.
Black churches had nothing to say about politics until Martin Luther King came on. Is that right?
Martin Luther King, he was the one that that really got that started. Huh.
So, in other words, so far as the center for black politics, it was in the taverns, in the what, 40s, 50s, or what? What years?
I'm talking about up through the Nelly, through the till the mid 50s, and up till near 60. The ministers probably got involved in around 60, early 60s, something like that. But not before that time. Mm-mm. No. Because they didn't mix politics with religion. No. You couldn't go into a church. See, we had no black representatives anyway.
Right.
In office until Harry Cole, and that was
54? Or was it 50? Which was it?
No, it wasn't
50. 54, yeah.
No, because I had a music box placed with the public address system, and I gave Harry his first public address system to go out and holler up and down the street when he was running for office. He ran three times before he won.
Hmm.
He was a Republican.
Yeah, I know that.
I was always a Democrat. But
right.
In the primary election, we could not ever get a candidate on the Democratic side through the primary.
Right.
And this was the only district you had a chance of ever putting a black in those days was right here where we're sitting now.
This was the old 4th district, right?
The old 4th district, yes, but Mr. Jack Pollock had everything sewed up in this district. And we were fighting him tooth and nail all the way so what would happen, a Republican didn't have any hard time as far as
the primary.
And we would back the Republicans in the general election. Who was Harry Cole? That's where we started right there with Harry. I was very friendly with Harry. He was a young lawyer. He was my lawyer at the time. And I was the backbone in raising his funds for his campaign.
All right, now, back in those days, you mentioned something about fighting against Jack Pollock. Now, Jack Pollock, as I recall, more or less controlled the liquor inspectors?
He controlled everything.
All right, well, if he controlled the liquor inspectors, he was coming around to the taverns, what sort of problems did you run into?
Well, now, when you say he controlled the liquor inspectors, let's see. I don't know if he controlled all the liquor inspectors, because that would only be, it wasn't too many at that time. Now, I tell you, your first liquor inspector, black, was put on by...
McKeldin, probably?
No, I think it was Nice.
Back in the 30s.
I think he put in Morris Calloway was an old-time Republican.
Old Marsh, yeah.
Morris Calloway was a liquor inspector and a fellow named Johnson. And they started under Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1936-37, we had, and all he was the first one put on a black policeman. Tom Butler, a fellow named Scott, and Gardner. That was Harry Nice. See, in those days, the Democrats would do nothing except once the Republicans, when they were in office, they would put some blacks in. and all the Democrats would do was just go along and replace, never no advancement politically mm-hmm. on the Democrat part. But the reason why I stayed Democrat was because most of the time the Democrats were in power, and we had to try to open the doors on that side, and naturally in the general election we all vote for the Republicans anyway. So we stayed that, but in the black section, they couldn't work nowhere but black terribly, so it was Morris Calaway or either Johnson. And then when they were out, when the Democrats were in, well, it was two blacks put in. Well, that was for the whole city. It didn't necessarily have to be Jack Potts, you know, mm-hmm. Inspectors. Because it wasn't just the public of the 4th District. That was the citywide. That was a thing from the governor's office. And after Nice went out, O'Connor went in. And O'Connor's lawyer, his law partner, was my lawyer. I worked for O'Connor in his election, and Joseph A. Rogan.
How you spell Rogan?
R-O-G-A-N.
Rogan.
Right. Rogan, if you go back through history, nearly anybody want to list a lookalike, they had to go through Rogan. That was his biggest field.
Yeah.
Yeah. He controlled the liquor board, Joseph A. Rogan.
But didn't Pollack at a later date have exercised considerable control over that board or not?
Pollack had powers that was unknown probably with most of the governors during that time. I don't know so much about Lane. I just can't recall, but he was a powerful man all the way
Well,
through.
Did you feel his power? Did you feel his power here in your community in reference to the taverns and so on?
No.
It didn't bother you?
No. Yeah. It was still all black right on, and we were doing business with black people, so it wasn't enough.
Yeah, but I used to hear reports that, for instance, if you didn't buy insurance from some company that was associated with Pollack, that then they would find all kinds of violations in your tavern and that sort of thing.
Well,
is that true or not?
No, I was against it.
You say no or not?
That might have happened with the whites, but it didn't happen to me, Pollack, never in life. Did he ever ask me to buy a policy from him? No.
Okay.
Now, Bill Dixon, the fellow up the street, he was one of Pollack's lieutenants, William B. Dixon, politically. All the way through, William Dixon, which in the end, his wife was one of the first legislatures down there, one of the first, Emma Dixon.
All right, and what did the NAACP, what was their attitude towards William Dixon and Jack
Pollack? Well, they weren't politically. They didn't have nothing to do with politics, the NAACP. They didn't get in politics, and Lily Jackson's family didn't get in politics at all until young Mitchell ran for office in 62. That was the first time they stuck their nose in politics at all, was when Clarence Mitchell, who is a state senator now,
right.
was Juanita Jackson's son. At 62, he ran on my ticket, our ticket for the House of Delegates.
Ran on your ticket?
Yes.
All right, now, getting back, though, before we get up into this more modern era, do you remember anything about the March on Annapolis in 1942 during O'Connor's administration? There were a couple of blacks shot by a policeman, white policeman, a black shot by a white policeman. There have been a couple of, I think, blacks shot. And
I can't recall.
You don't?
No. I was too busy probably running my business trying to make money.
I see.
42 would be right during when the World War II would start. We started in 41 and got involved.
All right, well, then when did you become active in politics then?
Well, I began to stick my nose in it when O'Connor went into office in the 40s. Just a little. I never was too interested in politics, but I helped with the cause a little. But however, I played a very small role in it at that time, but I had a problem with my liquor license, and I was, that's how I came about knowing Rogan's, because I had to go see Rogan. Someone told me to go see Joseph Rogan.
And what did Rogan say to you?
Well, after I went to see him, and the next, he became my lawyer, and from naturally, when old Connor came up for re-election, what have you, I gave him a donation. He wanted some money. I think I gave him $500.
Well, when did the Republicans start losing their power in the black community, and why, would you say?
I don't know, because that was probably, I don't remember them ever being in power except when Nice was in there, and I came to Baltimore in 31.
No, but the majority of blacks in the, certainly in the 1920s and early 1930s were
all
Republicans.
Republicans.
Right,
right.
And then they became all Democrats, or not all, but the majority of them became Democrats.
You had a lot of old heads that would never change.
I know, you got Archie Jones and you got the funeral guy. What's
and then most of them are dead now, you know, Woodlands and all that,
yeah.
which was Republicans. They were the backbones of the Republicans, I understand.
Yeah.
I really knew nothing about politics, really, to be involved in,
so
you in the 50s.
All right, but you have no comment to make on why most blacks became Democrats.
Well, the reason most blacks became Democrats was because, I think, of Roosevelt.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's why.
Because of what?
Blacks were only concerned about national politics at one time. They, even up until, they don't vote the way they should now, but hell, up until the 60s, the blacks didn't come out locally and vote the way they should until a general election, a presidential election, because they would come out locally every year and vote like they do in a presidential election. We would have had people in office many years before Harry Cole was elected. In 56 or whatever it was, they just wouldn't come out and vote. Just keep telling my vote means nothing. But in a presidential election, you would see how the precincts turn out to be altogether different. So I'm positive that Roosevelt. That
okay, and what did they like about Roosevelt?
Just thought that Roosevelt gave us bread.
Gave you bread. In other words, it was more of an economic thing, would you say, than anything else?
No question about it, yes. And he did act as though he cared about people. Look at the kids in the CC camps and all that he opened up.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful program.
Right.
Then he brought about the Social Security.
Right.
Which was in its emphasis, but he brought it about. During those days, you go back, when you had no security and you was old, you know, every corner was loaded with people with a hat out.
Yeah.
And that pretty much disappeared in the 50s.
Well, what made you decide to become more active in politics in the 50s?
Because I saw it was a need, and financially I was able to help.
Right.
I was never concerned in being in office myself, but I knew with the large number of blacks without representation, you were nowhere. And
I'd say your desire was primarily...
My wife became involved. She was very much concerned. She'd been a school teacher. And we opened a dress shop, 1811 Pennsylvania Avenue. So after she came out of the school system in the mid-40s. Around 1947 or 48, Mr. Law Randolph, who is a representative now, and who's the first man that introduced me to politics, was Law Randolph.
Which Randolph?
Representative Law Randolph. He's a House of Representatives.
Yeah, what's his first?
Law, L-L-O-Y-L.
Oh, yeah, Lloyd, yeah, okay.
Law Randolph had been in politics since in the 20s. But
right.
He got me involved, and I wasn't concerned. Now, I'm going back in the mid-30s, because the first I ever heard of politics, I guess, to any degree, was 1935. Alvin Jones, who is about 90 years old now, he was the first black Democratic senator. He defeated Harry Cole. He was a Pollock man. Pollock began to...
That was in 58,
he had
I guess.
To run a black, when he realized, in 58. Because then we defeated, which I was with Verda Wellcome at the time, we defeated Alvin Jones in 62 with Verda Wellcome.
Yeah.
Senator Wellcome. My arch, I guess, enemy politically now.
Yeah.
If you read the papers about the McDonald's restaurant.
Yes, Sarah Madonna, yeah, yeah. So in other words, you got active in the 50s because you're concerned about your people, right?
Right. Now, what happened first? My wife, Victorine Adams, who is counsel, Lady Victorine Adams at the present time, she started a drive to register blacks to vote. It probably was the first in the country. I know it was the first here in Baltimore City.
All right, now what about the NAACP drive to register?
They weren't doing nothing at that time. All
they weren't?
The NAACP came way late, I'm telling you.
What, on registering voters?
On registering to vote. If you check the history back, check the Democratic, the college Democratic women. My wife organized the Democratic women in the late 40s. Law Randolph asked her to do it.
And she did this in advance of any movement on the part of the NAACP to do comparable
work.
That's right.
They wouldn't touch politics during those days, NAACP. And this is, and I can be quoted on that and prove it if it's necessary. And this was in 46, 47. Because it all got started. We had a place, which we still have a place on the bay. The Law Randolph was renting a house down there for the summer. And we talked to my wife about the need for to get the organization together, the women. And my wife was out of the school system. So, and this goes 46, 47. And so she started an organization called the Colored Democratic Women, and they still have that organization. 1947 to 48, they were able, or in those days, you registered then in the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to get them to open the polls at night for people to register. And I gave my wife money to pay for buses.
Open the polls?
Yes, the voting. To open the registration office.
All right.
To open the registration office. To keep it open until like 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
We had one high school at that time, Douglas High School. Northwest Baltimore, Baker and Calhoun Street. She made arrangements for the people to be at Douglas at a certain time, and they would get on the bus, go downtown to register. I think they registered, and I don't want to say for an exact figure, but it must have been, and I don't know that over the period of time, but I know it was 8,000 or 9,000 people to vote, new registered people to vote.
And this is in 48 or 49, around there?
Around, could have been 47.
Yeah, okay.
48, but it was during that time. And I say again, you couldn't get the minister in the church or nowhere to do anything politically. It's just because you wouldn't mix the church with politics.
Nor NAACP.
And NAACP was doing nothing politically.
And Lily Mae Jackson wasn't touching it.
No, sir. They weren't involved at all politically. And they did not get involved until probably the early 60s or the late 50s. If they got involved, it had to be in the late 50s.
Well, when did, what made Clarence Mitchell III decide he wanted to run for office, and what made you decide to put him on your ticket?
Well, what happened, Clarence Mitchell III, I think, was about 22 years old, and this is 1962, and he was working.
Can I take my coat off?
Oh,
it's
yeah,
kind of
sure,
warm in here.
Oh, my God, you should have had it off.
Go ahead.
He was working with the a realty company, and this guy decided he was going to run for office, and Clarence was running on a ticket with him, and it had nothing to do with it. We had the 4th District organization, Berta Welcome and myself. So something happened between Clarence and this fellow. Evidently the campaign wasn't progressing, and Clarence came over to the 4th District and asked could he be on our ticket. And so we took him on our ticket. He was 22 years old, by his name being a Mitchell, very popular name,
right,
due to Lily Jackson. So he won a seat in the House of Delegates on our ticket.
Well, how long were you all close together politically?
I never was close.
You never were?
No. Right. Never was.
What,
we were just, oh, we were, my, starting with Harry Cole. Now, my wife had started this organization back, but I didn't bother with politics. I was concerned mm-hmm. with business. Politics didn't mean nothing to me, except it was a need for it, and I would support it financially.
Right.
But to be a political this, a political that boss, no. I was never concerned as far as being in that phase of politics. And whatever they say in the papers today, it all came about because, I guess, it was a need, and I was concerned, and I hardly know how to say no to people when it comes to something for progress.
Yeah. All right, well, in 1958, Mr. Adams, wasn't there a split during the primary period between your organization and the Mitchell organization?
They didn't have an organization in 58. They had
well, they were running some.
In the 60s. You talk about probably in the, it could have been 68.
Well, wasn't there...
It would be more
was
like
there
60.
Some split between you and somebody in that period in the 58?
Well, no,
a little vague.
Not in 58, because in 58, no.
There was no.
Welcome and myself, we went together in around 50. No, with her, let's see. We worked together. I took the old Harry Cole's organization.
When he became judge or what?
No, when he lost. Harry was in office for 4 years, that's all. He lost.
That's right.
And he had a fellow that was very much interested in politics, and he came around, he had to open the office in the back and let him work in it. So he's going there. His name was John, I can't think of his last name, but he was very dedicated. And Harry had no more interest in politics, evidently, after he lost.
Yeah.
He never was a good campaigner.
Yeah.
So if he had been, he could have been in office. There was no way in the world for Alvin Jones to defeat him. But after he was in office for 4 years, he knew everything. You couldn't tell him. He wouldn't get out and campaign. He ran his campaign from around in his office on McMack and